Hello and welcome to Main Street Universe's Thanksgiving 2012 edition here in North Branford, Connecticut. Your amazing host, Daniel Michael, will be with us shortly. This is his brother, Scott, broadcasting from my in-law's house here in North Branford, Connecticut, just about 20 miles east of New Haven. It's a great pleasure to spend this time with you here in the holiday season, and especially here in New England, which makes it feel even a little more like Thanksgiving because of all of the specialty that we see all around us, whether it's the turkey farm with the brightly colored turkeys or the little more crisp in the air as it is here in New England. We're blessed tonight to have a lot of students from the Yale School of Drama as guests of my father-in-law's for the Thanksgiving feast, and some of them may speak with us as they did last night. And so it's a great chance for us to come together and share some stories about this time. But first, let me share a song with us, with everybody, and I'll get right back to the show. And this is from the group Woven Green.
Hear all the stories of how Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special Thursday Thanksgiving edition of Main Street Universe. We're here live in New Brantford, Connecticut, with sort of a family gathering as well as a bunch of college students here with us on site. And right now, everyone down there, I would like to say hello to Yale Drama Technical Department. Say hello. One more time. All right. Thank you very much. And I am as well here with my brother, the Reverend Scott Samuel Michael. Say hello, Scott.
Hey, hello.
And we're all going through a little bit of a food coma here, but starting to snap out of it as these things happen. And we're going to talk about a few things. We're going to talk about the way Thanksgiving is viewed now, maybe even more so than how it was viewed in the past. I'm going to do a little bit about the history of this town that I'm visiting this evening. And I don't really mind the sound of the party behind me. I think that's actually kind of nice. And you can hear their energies rising a little bit. For a while, it was getting a little sleepy with all the food. And I'm going to do one brief song, basically because they're friends of mine that I ran into, and he plays the Chapman stick. I think I've played this song one other time on the show. And the name of this song is Let It Shine, the name of the band. I think they call themselves Euphoric Vibration. They were literally traveling hippies that were kind of young, and they were just going from town to town touring, and they happened to be at an open mic. And when I said, how much for your CD, they're like, whatever feels good to you. So, I think I gave them $10 for it. So,
still living in their van.
So here they are, Euphoric Vibration. The song is called Let It Shine. It's a Chapman stick.
If you're lost in the dark and if you can't see, if you're shivering in the cold night, turn up the heat. You got a fire burning deep inside. You gotta stoke it till it's burning up bright. Shine a light. Let love
We're back. And we're going to discuss a little bit about the history of this little town that I'm in for Thanksgiving this evening. My in-laws live here. And the second time I've been up here in New Branford, according to the Totocet Historical Society, in 1638, this town, New Branford, was established. That's the Puritan establishment. Of course, there were folks here before. It was considered to be without royal patent, authorizing them to occupy the king's domain. So they were here, but the king, of course, of England did not recognize the Puritan establishment. And as well, occupying this area were a group of Algonquin Indians.
Algonquin?
Yeah, Algonquin. And Algonquin is pretty wide. It's a language type. And the specific tribe they were members of were or became or linked to, because it was a pretty small group, and they were considered part of the Wangunk tribe. The chief's name was Montawese, if I'm saying that right. Algonquin was, again, a large sort of language group of tribes, which included many tribes, and were mostly in Canada, in fact. It is said that Montawese inherited Totocet, the original name for New Branford, Connecticut.
North Branford.
North Branford, yeah. What did I say, New?
Yeah, North.
Okay, North.
There is a Branford, which is older than the town.
Oh, okay. So in a way, it's almost accurate.
That's right.
So North Branford, known before as Totocet, which was inherited by Montawese of the Wangunk tribe, inherited from his mother, they say. And in November and December, I'm lumping this together a little bit. And I'm getting this, by the way, from the Totocet Historical Society is where I'm getting this information. And that society, by the way, started in 1975. And in November, December of 1638, the colonists started purchasing a lot of land in the area. And from Montawese and from some of the other tribes, the Kanipiaks as well, the Podunks and some others.
Did you say the Podunks?
Yeah, that was a tribe up here.
And the Pequot.
And the Pequot and the Narragansetts. There were a whole bunch of sort of smaller tribes, and then a few of the bigger groups. Some of those were a little more hostile towards these other smaller groups. And the Pequot were a Mohican group that would sort of try to exact tribute from the Kanipiaks and from the Wagunks and stuff like that. So they made some deals, coming down to it, with the settlers, with the colonists, the English, to, okay, we'll give you some of this land, and honestly, for not that much exchange, as a part of the deal, these tribes said, okay, but we get to hunt freely, and we get to be able to roam freely, and you help protect us from some of the tribes that we're warring with, which was the Mohicans and the Mohawks. So that's how a lot of those deals were made. And for a while, they lived in relative peace under that agreement. It was kept for a while. Then, as you know, history has proven, and what happens when you make funny alliances sometimes, eventually the idea of them not expanding further than the agreement, the agreement was broken to an extent. Here's what I mean, because I'm kind of stumbling around the point here. Basically, the colonists bought more land, and this part might be very important. They bought more land than what they actually settled on at the time, knowing that they were going to eventually settle on the extra land that was supposed to be kind of left alone. And, of course, that deal was broken, as so many were. So some would say, oh, well, you know, that was part of the agreement. But it was kind of, you know, a funny thing. And it's interesting, in the book, you see the marks made by the different chiefs. You know, one was just a simple tomahawk, one was a bow, and that was their name. And beyond those days, we step into the further history of this town and the chronology. Again, New Haven Colony purchases Totaket in December. Different land divisions are made. Then, you know, churches begin to open, and they have their first reverend, their first minister, which is a kind of a big deal. And in this case, it was Reverend Jonathan Merrick was the guy's name. Yeah, I was going to say, that's the elephant man's name. And that was in 1727. And Salem Northford becomes the Third Society of Branford. And it just goes on and on. And it divided into two different areas. And eventually, in the modern era, one was a little more maritime and wealthy. The other became a farming community. So that's just a little history of the area I'm in visiting here for Thanksgiving this evening. And glad to do a show. Kind of waking up from the food coma a little bit. And as you could hear, there's a whole bunch of college students downstairs playing a bunch of card games and other various games, which is sort of part of the tradition here. As the owners of this house both worked for Yale University and for the Ben Samar, who's my uncle-in-law, I guess, is the head of the technical drama department at Yale. And so when students can't get home, they often come here to have Thanksgiving and get a little rowdy. And with that, I'm going to take another brief break, maybe talk to my brother a little bit about some things going on. This song is from Tom Teasley, and this is another friend. everybody. We're back, and that was our friend Tom Teasley, who has agreed to be a guest on the show. The reason I have his material is because he lent it to me to use on the show, which I was glad I got his permission. He is sometimes one of his gigs, not the only thing he does, is a drummer for the State Department, traveling the world talking about hand drums. And I know there's a lot of musicians that would like an application for that gig. And we were talking a little bit about some of the history of North Branford, almost said New Branford again. And let's go into a little more. We mentioned the Pequots, and let's talk a little bit more about that history and the Pequot Massacre.
And hello, this is Scott. Someone call me Reverend Scott. I'm Dan's brother. So it's nice to spend this time on air with you all. And, you know, I want to tell the story, and I'm not trying to be a bummer on a holiday, but I am going to talk about where our current cultural conceptions of Thanksgiving come from. And for this, I get some of my background information from a man named Richard Greener, who's a researcher and an author. He's written the Locator novels, Richard Greener. And he writes, "The idea of the American Thanksgiving feast is a fairly recent fiction. The idyllic partnership of 17th century European pilgrims and New England Indians sharing a celebratory meal appears to be less than 120 years old, and it was only after the First World War that a version of such a Puritan Indian partnership took hold in elementary schools across the American landscape." Now, this is not to suggest that there were lots of partnerships. Yeah. There were lots of times when Puritans and other pilgrims and other settlers that weren't English had broke bread together. But the story that we hear of a harvest feast was an invention, a cultural invention, and we can thank the invention of textbooks and their mass production and purchase by public schools after the First World War for imprinting this Thanksgiving image in the modern mind. It was, of course, a complete invention cleverly created as a slice of cultural propaganda, says Greener, just another in a long line of such nationalistic myths. The first Thanksgiving Day did occur in the year 1637, but it was nothing like the feast we celebrate today. On that day, 1637, Massachusetts colony governor John Winthrop, who was also a minister, proclaimed a Thanksgiving to celebrate the safe return of a band of heavily armed hunters, all colonial volunteers. They had just returned from a journey to what is now Mystic, Connecticut, where they massacred 700 Pequot Indians, 700 men, women, and children. The day is still remembered 373 years later, and it's been long forgotten by many who are not Native American, but it is still fresh in the mind of many Native Americans. A group calling themselves the United American Indians of New England meet each year at Plymouth Rock on Coles Hill for what they say is a day of mourning. They gather at the feet of a statue of Chief Massasoit of the Wampanoag to remember the long-gone Pequot. They do not call it Thanksgiving, and they don't play a football game. So the interesting thing of what happened after World War I is this great misunderstanding was a true clash of cultural values and fundamental principles. And there's nothing wrong with being thankful for being here and for living on this land and surviving and prospering. But in our thankfulness, we may have overlooked something. And so without going into the entire history of what created this land and what, you know, the people who came before us had to do to create the USA, I just wanted to share a couple of these brief things about this particular incident. It was the Mystic Massacre. It took place on May 26th in 1637 in what was known as the Pequot War, when English settlers under Captain John Mason, along with Narragansett and Mohegan allies, set fire to a fortified Pequot village near the Mystic River. They shot any people who tried to escape the wooden palisade fortress, and they killed everyone in the entire village, which was mostly women and children. A lot of the men were out in defensive positions. And this was in retaliation for previous Pequot attacks as the white settlers began to invade upon their lands. So I think it's important to just point this out and for us always to be mindful of the totality of our history. And when we return, I'm going to share something briefly which is even more ancient than this, which comes from Europe, which gave the early European settlers, they believed, the legal and religious justification for this kind of conquest. And that is called the Doctrine of Christian Discovery. And now back to your distinguished host.
All right. And I wanted to point out that in the book by the Tohatakat Historical Society, now it's an older book, you know, and of course written by, you know, the people with the most gunpowder, as they say. And they do mention the Pequot Massacre, but they don't call it that. They call it a battle. Like, they make it sound more like a wartime battle. But there is a brief mention in the early paragraphs about that it even sort of sadly extended into almost wiping them out entirely, men, women, children. So they do mention it. They don't necessarily refer to it as a massacre, more like an unfortunate battle. So, you know, there's different ways of viewing things according to who's writing them. And we're going to take another brief time out because we're not trying to get too overly serious, but we're going to talk about a couple of serious things and then with some other relaxed things as well. And this next song is by Kellyanna. Maybe later on we can talk about European Celtic Thanksgiving, or the pagan Mabon might even come up. We have time for all that sort of thing. Some people call it the second harvest. But for now, I'm saying that because of our musician, who's sort of a Wiccan background, Kellyanna, who's been a guest on this show. And this song is Mother Love.
Mother, help me. Mother, heal me. Please release me from all things worldly that do not serve me. Mother, love me. Mother, help me. Mother, heal me. Please release me from all things worldly that do not serve me. Mother, I'm gonna break. do not
be changed if I, and I'm gonna break.
Mother,
be changed
love
if
me.
I, and I'm gonna
Mother,
break, break.
Mother,
be changed
heal
if
me.
I, and yes, I
Please
will.
Please release
break.
Me.
And we are back. And that was Kellyanna. And Kellyanna's been on the show, and I've seen her live at a New Age shop. And she was playing. She didn't have any equipment, but she had a big, gigantic voice in the place. She's kind of like one of those girls that has a slightly deeper range, but it's one of those big, booming female mid to deep ranges, but she can hit the high notes too. And her voice just is bah, and it was really amazing to see her. There was 50 people in this tiny little shop, and I was thinking, where's her PA now? It's a quiet and well insulated place. I think that helped a little bit, but it was I couldn't believe they got 50. It's a tiny place, and the place was sticks and stones. For those of you in the Virginia area, and Scott, my brother, Reverend Scott Samuel Michael, he knows exactly how small that place is. And to imagine 50 mostly women in there. I did feel like I was interrupting the coven a little bit, and which I think I was, but that's okay. I was received, you know, well and all of that. And we were talking about some of the history of New England, and as well we mentioned the Pico Massacre, as well as the history of the other tribes and their relationship with colonists. And my brother's going to go before and beyond that and talk about various doctrine and law in early Christianity. And I'm just going to let him do it because he does it better than me. Here you go.
I hope I did it better than you. I spent about 50 hours or more researching this for a sermon I did once. So if I don't do it better than you, they should fire me. So, yeah, I'm back. And I want to begin again at the Pequot Massacre. You know, again, I'm not trying to get overly damning of our forebears, but I am trying to tell the story straight. You know, people did what they were called to do with the reasoning that they were given. In 1637, or May 26, 700, mostly women and children, but some men too, were killed, Pequot natives in Mystic, Connecticut. And this was the result of an alliance with the white settlers of the Massachusetts Bay Colony and the Mohegan and Narragansett tribes banding together. But it's important to look at what people say are their motivations. The governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony at that point was a man named John Winthrop. He was also a minister, a Puritan minister. And it's important to remember that the Puritans believed not just that they were founding a nation, but they were founding a theocracy, that they were founding a country based on a particular set of religious understandings. And it is John Winthrop who, in United States history, lifts up the notion that America is the New Jerusalem, a shining city on a hill. This is right out of the Bible, out of Isaiah and other passages in the Bible. It was used by many different people trying to establish dominion in new lands. It was a beacon of hope for many peoples who thought they could take their own way of living and worshiping to a new place and establish it. You may recognize that phrase. Both John Kennedy and Ronald Reagan used the shining city on a hill. So it has echoes to our own times. But it was used as a specific justification to conquest lands, conquer peoples, and establish a certain religiously based system of governance. and in this case by the Puritans, a very extreme pietistic form of Christianity. And the reason that this was considered okay by international law and by religious authorities are manifold. Number one, simply, as Dan said, those with the most gunpowder were ruling, and that happened to be the Europeans. But as far as doctrines, there's a doctrine that's famous for propagating this sort of activity, not just in ancient times, but frankly to this day. It's called the doctrine of Christian discovery. This was a doctrine that had many different phases that were developed over time leading up to 1493. But in 1493, yes, 1 year after Christopher Columbus, Pope Alexander VI gave forth a papal bull called the Doctrine of Christian Discovery that gave both legal and religious justification for the kingdoms of Europe to conquer any land they came upon that was not already inhabited by Christians nor ruled by another European Christian nation. You've heard the phrase, for Christ and King. This is exactly where it came from. The conquerors came in and said that they were doing the work of the church and of the king. So they came with the armies, planted the seal of their nation, and right behind them would plant a cross, and the priests would come and encourage the local tribes to convert to Christianity, or they would have absolutely no chance of any kind of life on any equal par with the European conquerors. Now, that was really just a story. Very few of the European conquerors ever gave any of the native peoples of North and South Americas any chance to have equal footing and any kind of equal life within the societies that the Europeans established. It wasn't really until the late 1700s and mid-1800s that some people in some places tried that. But the early conquerors basically said, you will cut your hair, you will swear worship to our gods, and you will do as we tell you, and you no longer can control the resources in your ground. We can control all of the gold, all of the minerals, all the crops. You can no longer sell land to anyone because we are the only ones who can sell land to anyone. If you're nice to us and do as we say, we might give you a place to live, leave you alone, and feed you, but you will not have any self-determination. This was the doctrine of Christian discovery, a papal bull issued by Pope Alexander VI in 1493. And that date's important. It's before the Protestant Reformation. So even after England and Germany and other countries, Holland, broke from the Church of Rome, they continued to use this doctrine because it was accepted international law and it suited their own nationalistic and economic interests. Now, it's important to us in 21st century America because it explains in part, I believe, why our nation has been at war so often in its history. We have embodied in this notion of America as a shining city on a hill that we are a chosen people meant to spread our way of living, of our way of governing, our way of business, and our way of religion across the globe. And you hear that in all the statements of all the wars we've been in, especially even recent ones. So this is one reason to examine it. And another reason to examine this, even though it seems deeply embedded and long ago, is that it is still part of American law. In 1823, a Supreme Court decision known as Johnson versus Mintosh cited the doctrine of Christian discovery. Yes, the U.S. Supreme Court cited a 1493 papal bull as the justification for not allowing private citizens to buy land in the West from Native Americans. Only the United States government was allowed to sell those lands. What that did was it brought us into the League of Nations that used the doctrine of Christian discovery. Now, one of the things I think is most important to the religious enterprise is to examine what ideas, concepts, images form our basic assumptions. We often are not able to really examine what forms our basic assumptions. And I think this doctrine has formed a lot of basic assumptions at the foundation of America's idea of itself. This is what's called cognitive science, the study of how the mind works and creates its perceptions, beliefs, and assumptions. And this cognitive science tries to examine what we call reason and even the rule of law, because even these are terms that we have created over time. So let me share this with you. This is from the book Pagans in the Promised Land, Decoding the Doctrine of Christian Discovery from Stephen Newcomb. He writes, "It's my central contention that the American Indian nations in the United States have always been entitled to retain a free and independent existence. The U.S. government, however, has denied Indian nations a free existence and expropriated the vast majority of Indian lands by means of a dominating conceptual system. One of the most significant findings of cognitive research is that legal thinking is a product of the human imagination. It is not, as some assert, an earthly reflection of the mind of God or the order of the universe. A culture's legal thinking is created in the cognitive collective unconscious, where largely unexamined structures of thought live and breathe. The doctrine of Christian discovery is just such an unexamined structure of thought. Two unexamined cultural metaphors arise from the doctrine of Christian discovery. Indian lands, the North American continent, are the promised land, or lands promised by the Judeo-Christian God to the European Christians who founded the United States. And number two, that these European Christian people are a chosen people, chosen by God to take over lands of North America. These are two unexamined cultural metaphors foundational to the American mind." Now, he concludes, "Using the Bible as justification, American Indians are seen in the American imagination as the Canaanites or the pagans in the Promised Land."
And another interesting thing, or actually just to comment on what you were saying, for those, especially those that jumped in new, because a couple of new people jumped in the chat room, and that's yours.
Oh, there's
nothing to steal.
A refill.
Yes, and my brother was talking about, Reverend Scott was talking about, was how what was called the
doctrine of Christian discovery.
Doctrine of Christian discovery has been used to sort of dominate and justify empire in the names of countries well before America, but even the United States has used this doctrine and has cited it, if I heard him correctly, in a Supreme Court case, right?
Yes. And it is the foundation of all American Indian law.
And being used, as he said, as a foundation for American Indian law as well in dealing with the First Nation people. So, again, we're not trying to be downers here on the holidays. In fact, we're having a great time and are at a really nice party with lots of people. But we just wanted to talk about both sides, or the many. It's not always both.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things about, you said something that I thought was interesting, Scott, when you said what forms the sort of the foundation of our philosophies and how we see things. Mm-hmm. And myself, religiously, I'm a pagan, as well as a Unitarian, and pagan, Wiccan, whatever words you're all comfortable with. And one of the great things about being pagan, for all the flaws that pagan groups and everything have, one of the great things about it is the ability to see things as they are naturally, sort of the allegorical intelligence of picture language and of just seeing signs in nature. Instead of trying to force things upon nature, you know, it's that ability to just go, okay, well, that's how it is. Oh, this person's gay. Oh, okay, well, that's just how it is. It's a balance of energy. There's a little more, in a guy's case, a little more feminine energy, and we see that as just incredibly natural. One of the few things you can get pagans to usually agree on is they're pretty liberal about sexual orientation stuff, and usually environmental stuff as well. So we talked about some of the ugliness of the history of the relationship between not just natives here in the United States or First Nation people here in the United States, but elsewhere, according to the doctrine of a Christian discovery, and having that as a foundation. But we'll kind of bring it up a little more positive when we come back. We're going to take a brief break, come back a little more positive, and maybe just talk a little bit about thankfulness itself and what the actual holiday has sort of become in the modern consciousness. Like anything or any movement or any group of people, I always believe that it's about the people that are engaged in it, sometimes even more than the history of it. It is what it becomes. Yeah, that's sort of how I often... Sure. And my brother would like a last word on that, and then we're going to take a brief song and then come right back and then talk about maybe a little more of the positive side. But he sort of has a closing word before the song. And here you go, Scott.
Yeah, I don't always want to be the heavy. So, but I do want to conclude this segment on the doctrine of Christian discovery. I won't share everything I have because we don't have that much time. However, the need to me, the important aspect of the religious life is the examination of what is really true, of how did we get here, what are we supposed to do, how am I supposed to understand the world. And part of that is understanding our own humanity and the beliefs that underlie them. A focus on the doctrine of Christian discovery began in earnest in 1992, the 500th anniversary of the voyage of Christopher Columbus. And it became more urgent when in 2007 the United Nations passed the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which includes a summons to repudiate the doctrine of Christian discovery. And many people around the world, especially, you know, pagan peoples in the United States as well, embraced this. All nations signed this accord except for Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and the United States. No, we did not sign, because it is the foundation of American Indian law. And that's why it's not just a religious issue, it's also a social justice issue. In the 5 years since that was passed, a growing number of religious organizations have begun to support the call to repudiate the doctrine of Christian discovery, including the World Council of Churches, which is a Christian organization, and the Episcopal Church of the USA, as well as the Congregationalist Church of the USA. And just last June, the Unitarian Universalist Association's General Assembly in Phoenix answered a call to join those organizations, passing a responsive resolution calling for the repudiation of the doctrine. Religious institutions feel called to demand this because it was religion that was used to justify it. So if you're involved with any religious group, I encourage you, especially if you're involved with a more conservative group like Catholicism, demand that your churches repudiate this doctrine and try and share how it has really polluted how we think about people that are not white, European, and Christian.
And I wanted to also clarify, when he says American Indian law, what he means is how the U.S. government deals with First Nation issues or Native American issues.
Right,
he doesn't mean laws within inside of First Nation groups. He means
right.
How the U.S. government's first or their ongoing official policies
the U.S. government
are.
Still calls the laws that they have about First Nation Indian law.
That's the term that they use. But when we come back, we'll be a little more upbeat, a little more positive. But maybe try to keep still a little bit historical and view what the holidays become, what it means to different people. And this is a song from a friend of ours called Woven Green is the name of the band, Jim and Ashley Cash. And it's probably one of my favorite ones of theirs. It's called Sixth Son.
Thank you.
Perfect Sun, one of my favorite songs by them, by Jim and Ashley Cash. Great couple. It's a couple band. And if you've ever been in a band, you know how much they argue, like a bunch of drama queens. So imagine being married to your main bandmate. So even when all of the marriage arguments are over, as I said when I was interviewing them, what's it like to always know there's going to be, a band argument to rely on? I really don't want that change in that song. So I imagine it takes a lot of patience to be a married couple. Yeah. You don't take out the trash. Your chord changes are lousy. So we were talking about some history of the Thanksgiving, and as well as history of how different indigenous people are treated all around the world, really, not just in the U.S. My brother mentioned the doctrine of Christian discovery and how it's been used even not that long ago in history to be a foundation for dealing with First Nation people in the United States of America and also elsewhere. But now we're going to change. I just saw, speaking of, oh, here we go. Kevin Baird has just logged in. Hello, Kevin. How are you this evening? Ah, you just flashed a wink and a smile there. Very well. It's been a Thanksgiving party. We also got kind of serious for a while here.
That's my fault.
It's okay. But now we'll talk about Thanksgiving and the idea of thankfulness in general. And this could also go well because we got many reverends here now. We have Reverend Kevin Baird. And we have Reverend Scott Michael. And Kevin's sort of an alternative reverend. My brother is, Scott is a Unitarian minister. Kevin is actually officially in his tradition a cardinal, has the title of cardinal. And Rev Kev is the original co-host of mine when we started this network about a year ago, Main Street Universe. And I met him in a local New Age shop. And we started talking, and we hit it off well. We were talking at first, actually, about, Scott, we were talking about just doing a series of meditation CDs, sort of non-religious or non-traditional, I guess, based, just doing, like, guided meditations, because Kevin has kind of a nice deep voice, and people have told me I did. So I was like, yeah, we'll get into the studio, and we'll do some meditation, guided meditation kind of things. And then when we got to talking in the studio, we didn't get anything done at all. Mm-hmm. And we were like, well, we're talking. Let's start a talk show. So we started doing a Main Street Universe. And we both sort of came up with the name and the concept, which is about thinking outside of the box and also remembering that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined. So there's positivity here as well. So we're not always talking negative.
But you can't find the positive until you're honest about the wounds.
Of course. You have to be honest about the scars. The scars are even better than the wounds. They're the wound happens, and then you look at the scar and go, that's what I got to learn from that.
Not that again.
Don't stick the fork in the toaster kind of thing. Or with my old cat major, don't stick your hand in that windowsill during a certain time of day. Because that was a big, strong, very violent cat. And he really had some sharp claws. And you learn these lessons, and you get these scars in life. And it's great that Kevin could join us, actually. Kevin says, tattoos drawn on by fate. The scars. Very nice. And we're also joined by a guest. We've had some other people in and out. And thank you, everyone, for listening. We also did a show last night. And, Kevin, you can feel free to call if you're on a phone. So a little time. And we're going to drift into the positive side. And what I think people really think of when they think of Thanksgiving in the modern day, I don't necessarily think that most people, though to a degree they do, have the vision of the dinner with the two groups, the natives and the pilgrims. Most people, it's a day of gathering and eating and drinking with family and friends. in this case, about 15 college students are here. Mm-hmm. As you will hear, you might hear them behind us. During the introduction, they were all making some noise. They're downstairs. I'm in Connecticut, by the way, for those of you who don't know. And, oh, here we go, and I'm going to go ahead and take this and do something a little bit risky. No, maybe I shouldn't do that. But Kevin Baird, are you there?
I think I am.
Oh, great, great, great to hear you. Good to hear
you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yes, happy Thanksgiving to you. And we were on the air starting this network, and the last time we were together was you and I did a Oracle reading show. Kevin and I both read tarot and Oracle.
We're on the anniversary of that.
Yes, yes. And we had been on the air a year, and the episode you and I did on that Sunday night actually had really great ratings, and it was a lot of fun. Did a lot of readings. And how are things with you?
Good. I had Thanksgiving with the family today for the first time in probably 15 years.
Oh, wow.
After living in D.C. for about 30, but I would come and go into the Midwest as time would permit, scheduling and that kind of stuff. But now, since I live here, live there, it's a daily thing.
Hmm. So a return home for you.
Yes.
Oh, that's his home?
Yeah, he's originally from the Midwest, from Illinois, right?
Yep.
What town?
Carbondale, Murfreesboro area.
In the Carbondale area.
Carbondale?
Yeah.
That's South Illinois, right?
Yes.
Yes, he says it is South Illinois.
Cool.
And
I can hear Scott in the background.
Okay. I put you on speaker for a second, but I wasn't sure how that would affect the show because I'm on a landline show today that's on a old school, like, corded phone.
Usually I do
the show from a landline, but it's a wireless where you walk around and I put the mini wireless phones on speaker. I don't know how it affects it if I put you on speaker on this thing or if that does anything. I don't know. But that's okay. But, yeah, it's been an interesting week. We experimented, Kevin, for the first time last night with – we went out and did some digital recorder interviews and played them on the air. And one of them was with a store owner. And this store had been open since 1871, Bishop's Market, and has been a family tradition for a pretty long time, for about as long as my brother's wife remembers being alive. Going to this store, this market, but six generations of having a store. I mean, that's pretty amazing. And I see guests just typing. And I'm actually going, I'm scrolling down the list here. We actually recorded, it was our first time, you know, we're still expanding, still learning things. And trying to do interviews occasionally and going out on location. So, you know, tonight's a casual night where we had a little bit of a topic discussing a little bit of the history of this town. The guest has logged out. Maybe they like the other conversation better. I don't know. Oh, it was you. Oh, and you started typing. Okay.
I have a hard time figuring out how to get in your chat room. I got to do it for too many screens.
All you do is scroll down once you're on the show page. Do you have a membership at Blog Talk Radio?
That's what I mean. I don't.
That's why.
We can
you can't
Facebook
do the chat
in.
Room unless you're a member.
You
can
also Facebook into it.
Sort of Facebook in. But we're not trying to, you know, play those games, I understand, right now. And I,
you're talking to your
I am. And
I got it.
So we experimented.
So the show's about Thanksgiving?
It is. Now, we started with some ugly history, of course, with, the, you know, the First Nation people, the Native American mm-hmm. and their relationship with the colonists. And then now we're talking about more in the modern and just what it means to be thankful. For most people, Thanksgiving isn't even about that, you know, epic with the pilgrims and the First Nation people. It's more about getting together with family and being in an attitude of thankfulness, or as they say, an attitude of gratitude. And many people from many different religious traditions will always say that the best place to start a prayer is, of course, to be thankful. Maybe even better than starting from a place of forgiveness. Just start by saying thanks for what has already been provided. And as the, you know, law of attraction folks say, they will say that it'll help to attract more of the things that you need. Which, of course, the secret, as it's called, or the law of attraction, is basically just one of the hermetic laws. Now I'm going to play a little bit of this interview, Kevin. I'm going to go right to it.
Okay, go ahead.
Ah, so family name.
Yes, I'm a sixth-generation family member.
And that's pretty amazing. Somebody told me that before. This is a sixth-generation store. So that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's been here since 1871, family-owned and operated.
Okay. Yep. And mind describing just briefly a few things that you guys do here? I think you make your own apple cider and things like that as
we
well?
We do. Yep, okay. We make our own apple cider. We make our own wine as well.
Okay.
And obviously the wine bar here that's... We have over 300 acres of farmland. That's actually how the farm started. So, and apples are our largest crop. So that's how we have a lot of our products are apple-based, and they're our own apple cider, apple donuts, apple pies, apple wine, you name it.
That's fascinating. And six generations, that's pretty impressive. And I also know your guys' pain and pleasure, what you're going through today, because I work at Trader Joe's, so I know what it's like to work in a very busy environment. You guys are very busy today. I stopped by. I have family here, but I don't live here. Stopped by the turkey farm down the street that has the Ghazi's farm that has the electric blue and pink turkeys. But it's their part of their tradition. They've been coming here a long time. They're the Samor family who married into my family. And this wine bar is impressive. I like all the wooden structure. And a brief description of some of the wines that you make here.
Like I mentioned, all of our wines are fruit wines, so we don't have any grape. We don't grow any grapes, so none of our wine is grape
okay.
wine, which kind of throws people off a little bit. But the bulk of them are apple-based wines, and then, you know, with a little variation on each one. Some are apple-pear wines as a combination. Some have apples and raspberries. We have peach wines. We have an apple cranberry wine, which is great for Thanksgiving.
Absolutely.
And you know, the holiday in the wintertime. So strawberry wine, blackberry wine.
Okay.
So just anything we grow, we've basically turned into wine.
And I noticed how brightly colored they were. I saw the wine bar, and you're right, they're not grape.
Yeah.
There's bright green, bright red. They look like fruit juices at first. It almost looks like, are they alcohol beverages?
Yes, exactly.
But they definitely are.
Same alcohol content, your typical 11-12% as your, you know, any other wines would have. So
wow.
Know, people wonder if it's a little bit less, but no, it's the same as in your typical grape wines.
Hmm.
Most of the colored bottles are the actual color of the bottles. But that, you know, the blushes, the ones
sure.
with raspberries and the cranberries and things like that are that lighter, the blushy red color, pinky, you know.
Gotcha.
But, you know, they're good. Anything from sweet to sweet and dry to... you know, you've got your mix. Something for everyone.
So some of these apple wines actually do have a dry quality to them.
Yes. You know, the ones that are basic apple, you know, the straight apple wines, and then some of, like, the apple pear wines are drier. Like, one of our apple wines is very, very similar to a Chardonnay, and then we've got one that's similar to a Pinot Grigio. You get that apple aftertaste, that flavor, but, you know, if you didn't know better, most people do, but...
it's okay.
But we do, you know, we tell people, and once they try it, they're pleasantly surprised.
Okay. And two.
So, again, Bishop's is located in Guilford, Connecticut, for those who aren't familiar. And we have a website, bishopsorchards.com.
Okay.
And we have a thriving Facebook page that we're constantly making updates on, too,
so
with over 12,000 fans. So, you know, follow us on Facebook, see what's going on. If you get a chance and you're in the area, you should come on down.
All right. And that's Bishop's Orchard. And your name again?
Sarah Bishop Della Ventura.
Love that name, Della Ventura. Love that. That's right. But she's, as she was saying, Scott, six generations. She's not.
I am.
You are. You are number six. Oh, okay, okay. Oh, awesome.
My husband married into.
Gotcha, gotcha. All right, and that was that. What do you think, Kevin? I thought that sounded like a half decent little interview there.
Yep, that was good.
And that was with the digital hand recorder, handheld recorder. So we were doing a little experimenting. She was good, though. Wasn't she like a pro? She just jumped right in with PowerPoints all over the place. She wasn't the least bit nervous. It was a one-take shot. I just paused it for 1 second, almost accidentally. And I said, well, take a breath. And then I turned it right back on and said, what do you want everybody to know about bishops and contact information? And it was real simple. And it was almost like she'd done interviews before. She was very easy. There was no awkwardness. There was no, what are you doing here? Well, why are you talking to me? I mean, it was very like, bam, bam, bam. She definitely had that, you know, power about her. There was definitely a presence about her, you know. And anyway, we were discussing the modern way that people look at the holiday of Thanksgiving. And again, we were saying most people now, it's more just family gathering and then thinking about thankfulness and things you're thankful about. Some aspects of the story, of the Pilgrim Indian story, are true. Some are not. There were definitely alliances made, whether or not that actual, you know, sort of originating dinner happened in that way. Not really sure about that. Some say it was actually just a fictional account. But certain alliances were made, and other certain things to bring about the thankful time, of course, had always been around. We mentioned earlier the pagan Mabon holiday. The Africans have a harvest festival, and of course Mabon is sometimes called Second Harvest, and the cornucopia and those abundant images come from that harvest imagery. In that abundance, it's also considered a good time to cast abundance spells or wishes or wishing upon that moon in some traditions. The Native Americans also have snow moon in February for wishing upon, I think it's February, that full moon is considered one to, like, it's almost like the last great winter moon, maybe, was the idea behind it. So you make a wish upon that waxing moon for the stuff to come to you in the spring that's about to happen, you know, in a couple months. So there's lots of different abundance, wishing, and thankfulness traditions from all over the world. As Scott mentioned, there's a great African harvest tradition as well. And tonight we're in North Branford, Connecticut. And when we started the show, we started with a little bit of history of the colonists here and the local tribes here that live as well. And some of those included the Wongongs, the Kanipiaks, the Podunks, and Mohicans and Mohawks as well. And, of course, the colonists that arrived, the Puritans who were here without the consent. It was not considered king's domain, and they were considered to be here not on the king's permission. But, of course, they left England, so I don't really think that was much of a point for them. And someone else, though they don't look like they want to be in the host queue. Oh, hello. Barb Toll, and I see Babs in the chat room. And hello, how are you doing this evening? Good to see everybody here. Still in a little bit of the food coma, but I'm starting to wake up. I did eat a lot. And then on top of the whole dinner, I had a giant piece of cheesecake. And then, of course, these other traditions came about, the parades and all that. Yeah, and of course, the spirit of gratitude. I'm personally going to take a brief, very brief break here. And speaking of gratitude, I was very grateful to work with these guys, my brother here included. And this is a song we did from the old days called Their Blood Is Mine. This is from our old band. Yeah, well, thank you.
does it make us strong? Are they still here or have they all gone? Why have they left us alone? Their blood is mine, bringing me home. There is no time. Are we the same? Grown from the vine, stepped from the shade. Their blood is
talk more about the gratitude aspect of the holiday, of course. We talked about some of the history and some ugly histories that can happen with anything. And I'd first like to say, Kevin, we're going to start winding down here. And is there anything you would like to share? And Kevin is our host for our Friday evening show at 6 p.m. called Walking on the Sidewalk.
Yay. I wanted to say happy Thanksgiving to everybody and to think about our people in the Northeast and send them positive energy.
Absolutely. From Hurricane Sandy relief, and some people traveling up north saw some of that. And I'm going to go ahead. This is a statement on gratitude from Edie Halesum, a Dutch Jewish writer known for her diaries and correspondence from Westerbork concentration camp. And so that's kind of an interesting place to draw a gratitude statement from. And as life becomes harder and more threatening, it also becomes richer, because the fewer expectations we have, the more good things of life become unexpected gifts that we accept with gratitude. And I'll turn this over to
That's a powerful reading from a woman who didn't have any reason, most people would say, to be hopeful or to be grateful. That's because gratitude is a higher function. It's a quality of gentle strength and genuine love. So I ask us, how do we compose an attitude of gratitude? How can we slow down once in a while and discern what is truly meaningful in life and remember to offer up heartfelt thanks? The hallmark of any robust faith is gratitude. And may the words thank you fall off your tongue today more easily than yesterday. And may they fall off your tongue more easily tomorrow still. And I'm going to close my piece of this 2012 Thanksgiving edition of Main Street Universe with a prayer written by my very dear colleague who serves our church in Columbus, Ohio. This is from Mark Bellatini. So I invite you to breathe deeply and gently and get into whatever space you get into when you pray. Live simply, gently, at home in yourselves. Act justly, speak justly. Remember the depth of your own compassion, for it is deep. Forget not your power, even in the days of your seeming powerlessness. Do not yearn to be wealthier than your peers, and stint not your hand of charity. Practice forbearance. Speak the truth or speak not. Take care of yourselves, not just as spiritual beings or as intellects, but as bodies, because all of your being is a great gift. Crave peace for all people in the world, beginning with yourselves. Live with the dream of that peace alive in your souls, and with grateful hearts and minds, command your tongues to sing songs of praise. Thank you. Praises be.
All right, everyone. And now, with a slightly upbeat closing after a pause, we are actually at a pretty fun party here, part of the whole thankfulness, which reminds me that one of my favorite quotes by Plutarch, the philosopher, was, "The worship most acceptable to God comes from a thankful and cheerful heart." So it's always good to have fun as well. So as I step out here, I'm reminding you that you've been listening to the show, which lets you know that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined. And remember, the archives can always be listened to in the archives section. And thank you very much for listening, everyone in the chat room. Thank you, Babs. And let me step out here for just a second. And you've all been listening. What show is the greatest radio show that has ever existed?
Main Street Universe!
Thank you very much, everyone. And have a great Thanksgiving evening. And we'll end it with, blessed are we, because we are blessed. Thank you.
Blessed
thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, everyone.
Blessed.